It's said by our previous acharyas that there are two topics that are particularly difficult or involved and complicated and kind of elusive. And this is one of them. Besides, you know, some people feel this and some people feel that. To have a proper understanding of the whole subject matter, it's not easy. Guru Tattva and Shiva Tattva are true, stated by our acharyas. Very difficult. So, and you'll see as we go along. The primary reference source that I'm going to be making this presentation from is Sri Brahma Samhita. Do I have a copy just to show them? Sri Brahma Samhita is one chapter out of 100 chapters of a book that was found by Lord Chaitanya when he was visiting in South India, the Adi Keshava temple, very far South India. And he made a copy, and he traveled with it, that copy back to Puri, where he was keeping his residence. And it then became distributed amongst, he recommended it to his followers, and they all were very eager to read it and propagate its message. Then one of the immediate generation following him, the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, some of you don't know what that is. Not yet. Okay. Jiva Goswami was one of the direct followers of Lord Chaitanya in the next generation, and he wrote a Sanskrit commentary on this text, because Lord Chaitanya said this text gives, kind of skinny, less skinnier than Srimad Bhagavatam, which is really much bigger, but the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam is here. So we're going to be referencing three verses from Sri Brahma Samhita to help us understand the position of Lord Shiva. And then from that, those references, others we'll see as we go along. So this is the first verse of Brahma Samhita. And the first line of the first verse is what emphasis goes to, and I'll explain in just a moment. So let us chant the verse together.
Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarva Karanam.
So Ishvara Parama Krishna. Krishna is amongst all of the Ishwaras, he's the Parama Ishwara. He's the supreme amongst all controllers. He's the controller of all controllers. So there's a section, 11 verses. You'll see those 11 verses listed in a moment, that expand this idea, this first line. Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the supreme Godhead. He has an eternal, blissful, spiritual body. He is the origin of all. He has no other origin. And he is the prime cause of all causes. That's the translation of that first verse. This first verse is said to be a Paribhasha Sutra. What does that mean? Sutra, you know, from Vedanta Sutra. Sutra is a little aphorism, little packed up statement. And within that statement is lots. So, paribhasha.
Definition.
condition.
Hari,
Sanskrit meaning is around, bhasha, language or speech, so put the two together. Hari bhasha is to speak fully.
Or to explain or define. So a Hari bhasha sutra, it generally, it comes, there's a long definition from Sanskrit terminology, but when there's composition of a literature, in the beginning, towards the beginning of a literature, commonly, there's a essential verse that there's rules that it's like an emperor amongst kings. It rules all other statements within that literature. It is said that there may be seemingly unrelated subject matters presented, a whole series of them, hundreds and thousands of them, like a king rules many citizens. But there's one, if you want to properly understand all those subsequent statements, it must be understood in light of this one. So this one, the first verse of Brahma Samhita, is described as that Hari Bhasha Sutra. And if we had more time, I'd give some other examples. But we're just going to keep going forward. So, in that first line, Ishvara Parama Krishna, here's the texts that should be showing one after the next, but it's not doing that. So, we're going to be discussing this one, the gradation of realms, where from Devi Dham, Mahesh Dham, Hari Dham, and Goloka Dham are mentioned. We're going to explore where Mahesh Dham fits into all of that. So the abode of Mahesh, and then text 45. So Lord Shambhu. And in all of these, Anantashesh, Lord Brahma, Ganesh, Suryadev, etc., all of the principal personalities governing, ruling the affairs of the universe, from where do they derive their power, their potency to shine, Surya, or Ganesh, his potency to remove obstacles, or anyone to do anything in our ruling personalities, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Vajami. That's the refrain in these stotras within Brahma Samhita. So, we're going to go on to text 43 and see, especially pay special attention to the abode of Lord Mahesh. So, if you like, we can chant this verse together. Now, there's a sound. Does it work? Oh. So the second line, Goloka Nami, the Dhamma of Govinda is called Goloka Dham. And there's others, Devi Dham, Mahesh Dham, Hari Dham. There's others, Each of these personalities have their respective residence and the corresponding opulence of that residence, and they're all in pursuance of Lord Govinda. So here's the translation. The translation is given by Bhakti Siddhanta, taken directly from this text. Lowest of all is Devi Nam. Devi Nam. The mundane world. Next above it is, we'll do a close zoom in.
But Mahesh Dham is in this region, outside of the universe,
but not yet within the Hari Dham region. There you see that yellow arrow. There is Mahesh Dham. Yeah. And then above that is Hari Dham. The abode of Hari. Vaikuntha realm. And then above them all is located Krishna's own realm named Goloka. So there's Goloka at the very top. Devi Dham, Mahesh Dham, Hari Dham, and Goloka. You see in the margin, this chart is drawn according to descriptions from scripture, just depicting in a visual form. So in the earlier in texts 3 and 4 and 5 of this Brahma Samhita, it describes Goloka as being a whirl like a lotus, and in the center of the whirl is Radha and Krishna, and surrounding Radha and Krishna are the petals, which are the abodes of the gopis and other residences of Vrindavan. And there's much more detail described.
Swami, what is the difference between Hari and Krishna?
Well, we're going to do, who is Lord Shiva first?
I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who has allotted their respective authorities to the rulers of those graded realms. So the theme throughout these Govinda prayers, well, I'll remember your question at the end, but let me do this. So there's one absolute truth. There's not multiple. From that one absolute truth, by Vedanta definition, everything is coming. And that one absolute truth, according to Brahma Samhita and according to Srimad Bhagavatam, is Bhagavan. Bhagavan has different features. Bhagavan, Paramatma, and Brahman. These are all features of the same absolute truth, but in the highest feature is Bhagavan. And Bhagavan expands his potencies to create different realms or dhammas or residences for the different personalities that make up the spiritual and material world. That's what the verse is saying.
Now we're going to focus a little bit.
Each of these graded realms is invested with appropriately graded powers and opulences, and those powers and opulences come from Govinda, according to the language from the purport. The Supreme Lord Govinda, by his own direct and indirect power, has constructed those respective potencies of those realms. Here's another chart similarly doing the same thing. So at the bottom, this is Devi Dham. This is Garbhadakshay Vishnu at the bottom. There's the lotus growing from Garbhadakshay Vishnu's navel. And the 14 planetary systems are found within that stem of the lotus, and on top, Lord Brahma. And then there's coverings of the universe, seven coverings of the universe, or layers, like the coconut shell surrounding the inner hollow part of the coconut. And then beyond the coverings of the universe, there's the Garbhadak Ocean. Excuse me. Karana Ocean. The causal ocean. And Mahavishnu is lying in the causal ocean. On the other shore of that causal ocean, but I'm in upwards direction, is Maheshnam. You see in the drawing, there's Mahesh riding on Nandi. And then on the other side of that is the Brahmajyoti, and the other side of the Brahmajyoti, or within the Brahmajyoti, is Haridam, the abode of Hari. You see in the left margin, Haridam. So, question. Where is Maheshdam? Because it's not within the material energy, and it's not within Haridam either. It's a separate place or entity. There you see the close-up. There's the universe, Garbhadak Shai Vishnu at the bottom, filling up half the water with the Garbhadak Ocean, Lord Brahma at the very top. The different coverings, they're named according to the elements that make up that covering. On the other side of the covering is the Karana Ocean, sometimes called the River Viraja. Have you heard that term before? The River Viraja. And then there's Shambhu up top. And beyond Shambhu, Siddhi, the very, very top of this photo, there's Sadashiva Loka. Take note of that, because Sadashiva Loka is, you're going to hear some details from scriptural passages that I'm going to read to you, but just right now, the visual part. Lord Shiva is a complex entity, being. So he has different features of him, and according to those features of him, he has different abodes or residences. It's just a different terminology that applies to the same person according to his position. Hang on, it's going to get complex. Shambhu is a name of Lord Shiva, or Shiva is a name of Shambhu, and the name is used according to the function that he's performing. It's the same person, but he has different functions, and according to his function, a name and a residence. Okay? And so at the very, very top of one of the four abodes of Lord Shiva is Sadashiva, whose abode is Sadashiva Loka, that's in the lower regions of Haridam. Let's go, there's a little more detail, as far as the artist's, your picture speaks a thousand words, right? So the Lord Shiva that people commonly worship in this world, he's in this world. And his abode is Kailash. The abode of Lord Shiva is Mount Kailash. In this realm. There's another one called Shiva Loka, and there's another one called Sadashiva Loka. And there's a fourth one. I told you it was going to start to get complex. Called Mahakalapur. And Mahakalapur has about four different subdivisions. Let that sink in for just a moment before we go on. So we're going to look first at Sadashiva Loka, as you see in letters beneath that, that's Mahesh Dham. And then, but there's another abode of Mahesh, where he's known as Shambhu, found, the nomenclature Shambhu, found within Brahma Samhita, refers to that feature of Lord Shiva that is the halo of the glance of Mahavishnu. What? Mahavishnu. We know who Mahavishnu is. From Mahavishnu, the universe has come and stay for some time in the manifest feature, and when cosmic annihilation takes place, all the elements go back to their undifferentiated position. They reside outside as like a shadow or a cloud of material energy, and the living entities enter into a dormant state of consciousness called susupti, and they enter the body of Mahavishnu. And there they stay for equal duration of time, two parardas, according to Bhagavatam, the period of cosmic manifestation, equal of duration is the cosmic annihilation. Cyclical. So those living entities, when they're within the body of Mahavishnu, described in Brahma Samhita and Srimad Bhagavatam, there's two compassionate desires of Mahavishnu. One, those living entities that are dormant within me, I wish that they, instead of being dormant, that they could experience the highest position of happiness possible for all living entities. I wish that for him, for them. Compassion. Second is he's enjoying pastimes with his internal potency. Her name is Rama. Just like Narayana in Vaikuntha, her name is Lakshmi. Or in Ayodhya, her name is Sita. And in Goloka, her name is Radha. And in Dwarka, she's known as Satyabhama or Rukmini or one of the queens of, but it's the same internal potency manifested variously according to the Lord's position, his function or his abode. So Mahavishnu is enjoying with Rama Devi. And he is enjoying with her within. Question. When you see pictures or paintings of Mahavishnu, do you see Rama Devi? No. Why don't you see Rama Devi? Answer. She's within. He can manifest her externally or internally, and he's enjoying, Mahavishnu is enjoying yoga nidra. You've heard that term before. Nidra means slumber or rest. It's different than our, you know, what we do at night. He is enjoying pastimes with Rama Devi, his internal potency, eternally, eternal pastimes. And Rama Devi has a shadow reflection, Chaya Devi. And Mahavishnu considers she also wants some service. She doesn't have any service and she wants some service. I'd like to give her some service also. Compassion. So compassion and compassion. So what happens? Rama Devi, she's the confidential associate of her Lord and Master, Mahavishnu. She knows his desire and she wants to fulfill his desire. That's who she is. His internal potency. So she, to assist Mahavishnu's desire, she transfers all those living entities that are in their dormant state, and she transforms her one of her subpotencies called time or Kala Shakti. She has many assistants. Eternal time is one of them. She transforms that eternal time into time as we know it, which is not eternal time. Ours is past, present, future time. But that's just a transformation of eternal time. And she entrusts the living entities, two things, and time to the glance of Mahavishnu. That's Shambhu. Shambhu is the halo of the glance of Mahavishnu. And that glance of Mahavishnu contacts Pradhan, the material energy. There she is, Durga. And then that glance of Mahavishnu, Shambhu, creates the original procreation act, where then the living entities are injected within the material energy, the womb of the material energy. And along with the time energy, then everything starts to differentiate. The undifferentiated elements start to separate out. And more things start to happen to allow the process of creation to go on. So that's that Shambhu that's pictured on Nandi in that realm called Shivaloka. Above Shivaloka is Sadashiva. So, from the purport, next above Devi Dham is located Shiva Dham, one portion of which is called Mahakala Dham, enveloped in darkness. That's Bhakti Siddhanta's language. And I'm going to give you, in the next slide, some scriptural references that say where that is. Interpenetrating this portion of Shiva Dham, there shines the Sadashiva Loka, full of great light. So the illustration shows there's Sadashiva Loka at the top, and then there's a darker portion below. That's Mahakala. Okay? This is just an artist's rendering of what is stated in the scripture. And I'm trying to unpack it for you folks slowly, help you understand this complicated subject. Now, down at the very, very bottom is that bright light, Sadashiva Loka, that is in the lower region of Haridham. There's the Brahma Jyoti and different, this is one of the unlimited Vaikuntha planets depicted in the way as you see it, it's a yantra. What's a yantra? Yantra is, it's a mystical diagram, one way to say it in English. It's a configuration, a two-dimensional depiction of something that's spiritual. The abode of the Supreme Lord is depicted in a yantra. And it's part of a process of worship. Some of you are from South India and you've seen yantras. They're part of the worship of Narayana, or like in our temple in Mayapur, there's a Nrisimha deity, and in front there's two Nrisimha yantras. So this is a... What's that? Oh! Okay. So above that there's another yantra, the Goloka yantra. This is Haridham yantra. But the purpose of showing this to you is down at the bottom, there's Sadashiva Loka. In the lower regions of Haridham, at the upper region of Haridham is Ayodhya, and then above Ayodhya is Goloka Dham. And as I described, the internal part of Goloka Dham is Radha, Krishna, and their atonement. There's a close-up of Goloka Dham. So now, where is the abode of Mahesh? Well, it's not in the material world, at least according to Brahma Samhita. Even that Mount Kailash, which is within the parameters of one of the universes, or each of the universes, there's a Lord Shiva in each one of those universes, that's in Kailash, and those who are worshippers commonly, those that are worshippers today and, you know, since creation of Lord Shiva, are worshipping that feature of him. But this Brahma Samhita is telling us that he has different features. Can we have the Adi Lila? You printed it, very good. So, in Adi Lila chapter 9, chapter 6, there's a discussion of Advaita Acharya. You know, in our Panchatattva, Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Sri Advaita, Gadadhar, and Srivas. So, way over here is Advaita. And Advaita is a manifestation of Sadashiva. So, mentioned in one purport of this verse 79 is reference to in the Puranas it is found. That Shiva appears sometimes from the heads of Brahma. That's a little complicated, but it's true. There's a prototype Shiva. We're getting complicated again. What's a prototype Shiva? And there's a prototype Brahma, from whom all Brahmas come, and there's a prototype Shiva from whom all Shivas come. And that prototype Shiva, according to one of the Puranas that's referenced, is that appears directly from the head of Lord Vishnu. I told you it was going to get complicated. I'm fulfilling my promise. Those of you that are familiar with Srimad Bhagavatam and other of the Saptic Puranas, it describes in the process of creation, Lord Brahma appears, according to the indication of Lord Vishnu, he's to assemble the universe, not exactly created, but the engineer of the universe, he puts it all together. And after he puts it all together, he is supposed to fill it up with living beings. So for that purpose, he wants some assistance. So he expands himself into the four Kumaras and requests the four Kumaras, please assist me. Engage in the activity of becoming Prajapatis, produce good praja. And they say, no. We want to stay brahmachari. So Lord Brahma, hearing this, his first children saying no, he becomes angry, and from his brow comes Rudra, another name. Now we have three names. Actually four. Sadashiva,
Shambhu,
Lord Shiva, and now here's Rudra. Rudra means anger. I told you it was going to be complicated. And then there's the prototype Brahma from whom all Rudras appear. The annihilator, Rudra, is born from Sankarsana and the ultimate fire to burn the whole of creation. In the Vayu Purana, there is a description of Sadashiva in one of the Vaikuntha planets, in the lower region of Vaikuntha planets. That Sadashiva is a direct expansion of Lord Krishna's form for pastimes. A direct expansion of Lord Krishna's form for pastimes. So there's multiple aspects or features of Lord Shiva already that have been listed, and I haven't completed the list yet. It is said that Sadashiva, parentheses Lord Shambhu, is an expansion from the Sadashiva of the Vaikuntha planet, and that his consort Mahamaya is an expansion of Ramadevi. Mahamaya is the origin or birthplace of material nature. So the glance of Mahavishnu, Shambhu. The glance contacts material nature, Pradhan or Maya. And so Mahamaya or Maya becomes the birthplace, the womb of material creation. Prakriti, material nature. And the impregnation of Prakriti is through Shambhu, who is the halo of the glance of Mahavishnu. Okay? I'm going to take a deep breath so that we can go on to the next thing. Yeah.
You mentioned about Chaya, right?
Yeah.
The reflection of the Ramadevi.
Yes.
Is she and Maya are
yes.
the same?
Yes. The nomenclature refers to the function. So Maya Devi is more like a category, and Chaya Devi is specifically the function.
So when the material nature was formed, she became Maya. But before the material nature was formed, she was Chaya. Is that
not exactly? Yes, but it's again, it's just a nomenclature. Just like, you know, you have children, and sometimes you call your child by some nickname. And sometimes when you want to be stern, you call her by another name, or him or her.
Right.
Sometimes it's, yeah, sweetie, and sometimes it's, you know, but it's the same child. Same child, just, you know, so similarly, at the state of when that undifferentiated totality of material elements can be called pradhan. Or, if one thinks of that pradhan to be the reflection of Ramadevi, we refer to her as Chaya Devi. And from the but that's Mahamaya. That's another all-encompassing term. Or Prakriti. So it's different terms indicating different features or aspects of the same entity.
That, like
you've been talking
about the
different towns, right? Yeah. So if you are obviously in Devi
Ram and you're referring to that Shakti, you're talking
about Maya. But then when you go above and you are in the Hari Loka and then you look down, you're talking, you're going to refer to her as Rama. Yeah. That's, yeah.
So that's
yes. Something. Yes. Just like, yes.
Okay.
So Lakshmi. Lakshmi is the internal potency of Narayana. And according to the Srimad Bhagavatam and other Vedic literature, Narayana, this is now, you know, what's the position of Narayana? Rather than the position of Lord Shiva. But Narayana is expansion. And she, Lakshmi, is expansion of the internal potency of Golokadham. Same entity. Same personality. Different position, different feature, and you'll see if I just get a little bit further on the presentation, then different aspects of the fullness of Bhagavan are manifested, which is going to be an answer to your question, the distinction between Hari and Krishna. We'll get there. But I just want to still stay focused on the position of Lord Shiva, because I was asked to speak on that because you've been discussing it a little bit. And allow me to continue in this complexity. There's another reference, a long section of verses from Brihat Bhagavatamrita. What's that? Brihat Bhagavatamrita is a commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam, written by Sanatan Goswami. And he was one of those six Goswamis, direct associates of Lord Chaitanya in the next generation, that was one of the principal acharyas that put in writing, in a written form, Lord Chaitanya's teachings that are based in and grounded and rooted in Srimad Bhagavatam. So that commentary is called Brihat Bhagavatamrita. And in this part two, because there's part one, part two is a, the journey of a fiction character named Gopa Kumar. Literally means cowherd boy. He's born in Vrindavan. And he's with his cowherd boyfriends. And there's this very exalted brahmana that from time to time, as they're taking care of cows, they see this brahmana, and Gopa Kumar becomes really attracted to him. So he kind of goes away from the cow herding and sits with the brahmana, and he gives him some instructions, and eventually Gopa Kumar, just a little boy, he wants to receive initiation in the chanting of mantra, Gopal mantra, or Madan Gopal mantra. That's one of the essential Gayatri mantras within Vedic teachings. So his spiritual master agrees, tells him to go take bath in his Jamuna, come back, and he performs a little ceremony and he gives him this Madan Gopal mantra. And this Madan Gopal mantra makes Gopa Kumar, this little boy, spiritually enlightened, progressively more and more and more and more. And Gopa Kumar goes to different places on the power of this mantra. And one of the places he goes to is Sadashivaloka. And to get to Sadashivaloka, he passes through the coverings of the universe, because it's on the other side of the coverings. And it describes what it's like in those coverings of the universe, and it's not like a coconut shell. It's a dham. And it's vastly, thousands of times more opulent than the topmost planets within the universe, which he's already experienced. And each successive layer is like that too, and further and further and further. And he gets on the other side of the coverings of the universe, and he encounters something else. This, the formless feature of the Supreme that seems to like come out of nowhere and starts to take shape, and he feels himself being drawn and pulled into that entity. And he chants his mantra, and then it recedes and says, he just said, no, I don't want it. I want Madan Gopal. I want Madan Gopal. And then off in a distance, he hears a kirtan. And it's the followers of Lord Shiva. Because they're descending from that Shivaloka realm to enter into Devidham to give his association to the persons who are struggling down here in the material creation. And he's this little coward boy. He doesn't know who that is. So I'm going to read to you what he sees and the exchange. The book is there. The text right here. Okay. Enlivened. Looking all around, I saw someone riding on a bull. A unique person. Arriving from a higher region. Three-eyed, white like camphor, dressed only by the sky. That exquisitely beautiful person carried a trident and bore the half moon on his head, his matted locks brilliantly adorned by the Ganga. His body was smeared with ashes and graced by a charming garland of bones. Sitting on his lap, a woman of fair complexion affectionately served him. Divine regalia surrounded him, more heavenly than the riches of heaven. And many followers attended him, their attractive forms and behavior just fitting for his service. Feeling the greatest surprise and delight, I thought, who is this? Just a little boy. Accompanied by such an entourage and appearing from above, the abode of liberation. That's like that Sadashivaboka. Or he looks more powerful than anyone else in the material world, more excellent than all liberated souls, yet he seems to violate the rules of civilized behavior. Like a great sense gratifier, my mind was overcome by the weight of the supreme ecstasy I felt from seeing him. I bowed down to him and those who stayed with him, and he gave me a compassionate glance. Impelled by joy, I approached the leader of his companions, named Sri Nandishwara, and I asked him in detail about this person and what was he doing. Nandishwara laughed and said to me, "Oh, cowherd boy, devoted worshipper of Gopal, don't you recognize Lord Shiva, the Lord of the universe? He is the giver of material enjoyment and liberation, and he expands devotion to the personality of Godhead. He is worshipped even by the liberated and is dear to the Vaishnavas. Drawn by the devotion of his friend Kuvera, he is traveling with his beloved Parvati and dear gentle companions to grace Mount Kailash with his presence. He came from his own planet, as transcendental as he, an abode reached through devotion by those who see him." And Lord Krishna is none different, because as we heard from Vayu Purana, that Sadashiva, this one, the first one, because there's going to be three others, is an direct expansion of Lord Krishna for the purpose of Krishna's pastimes. And here's one of his pastimes, recorded in Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So that's one of his abodes and one of his manifestations, this Sadashiva. Ready for the next one?
Swamiji, were all the Bhagavatams written at the same period of time? Like Srimad Bhagavatam and then we say...
The Brihad Bhagavatamrita is a commentary.
It's a commentary. Okay.
So Swamiji, Shiva is the
Lord
of Krishna?
We'll get there, because that's text 45. But he has it's first of all, I want to make it... Maybe all the details you're not going to remember tomorrow. But one thing you're going to remember, there are different manifestations of him, and he has different abodes per those manifestations. So he's not... He's complex, and according to Brahma Samhita, his abode is not in Devidham, although he goes to Kailash, but it's not to be considered that that's part of this material world exactly, although it's within the material world. It's Maheshdham. And then he has other places. Some of them are at the bottom of the universe. But they're not, you know, within the universe. It's Mahakala Pur. Per the description that you're going to hear as soon as I get there, it's the abode of darkness. There's the abode of light. That's Sadashivaloka. That's where this description, where he's coming from.
Is Mahakalapur part of your
poem? Well, we'll get there. It's number four on the list. I'm still at number one. Yes? Huh? Two things before I keep going, okay. You're a good group. You're keeping me really busy. I think we're going to be here till 12 o'clock at night.
You already mentioned about Zen as the glance of Vishnu.
There's different features of him, but yes, that's one of them for sure. That one term doesn't only and always only apply to the glance. It's sometimes used in different contexts. So don't get confused when it's used in different contexts.
Is it okay to understand that he is Sambhu is there as part of Vishnu?
We'll say that when we get to text number 45. Yes, thank you. Maybe if you let me do the presentation, all your questions will be answered. Okay. Go ahead. No problem. I'm very flexible. I do yoga. Bhakti yoga. She is the manifestation of the reflection of his internal potency. There's internal potency and there's the reflection of the internal potency. Is that right?
Is this external potency
is
inclusive of internal potency?
It's an expansion of the internal potency. That's as a reflection of an object exists because of the object. There's no existence to the reflection without the object. There's no existence to Mahamaya without Yogamaya or Ramadevi. Yes. Okay. She is one of the Lord's potencies. Eternally. She's co-eternal with him. She's one of his potencies. And he wants to give her some service. She wants to do some service. Okay. Now, where's the book? Text 15. Remember that word prototype, Shambhu? Okay, here we go. Text 15, Brahma Samhita. I'll read the verse. Listen, I'll read it slowly. And try to explain it. So the previous verse, text 14, is something you're familiar with. Text 15, you're not. So 14, Mahavishnu entered into each universe as his own expansion. Garbhadakshay Vishnu expands from Mahavishnu within each universe. Yes? Okay. The divine expansions that entered into each universe are possessed of his majestic extension. What's that? They are the eternal universal soul, Mahavishnu. They're expansions of him. And they have his same potencies. Okay? That's text 14. That's what you're familiar with. That same Mahavishnu created Garbhadakshay Vishnu, that expansion from him, from his left limb. Brahma, the first progenitor of living beings, from his right limb. And from the space between his two eyebrows, Shambhu, the divine, masculine, manifested halo. So this is Mahavishnu before... That same Mahavishnu is not a chronological, it's an ontological statement. What's that mean? It's a, ontological means Shambhu, the original Shambhu, that includes that halo of his glance, that one, comes from Mahavishnu. Lord Brahma, who later on enters into each one of the universes, has an original. You know what the word prototype is? Anyone not clear what the word prototype is? Not clear? You all know what it is. So the prototype Brahma, from that prototype Brahma, all Brahmas come. Each universe has a Lord Brahma. Each universe has a Lord Shiva. And the original prototype from which they come, comes from Mahavishnu. Just as the Garbhadakshay Vishnu that enters into each universe comes from Mahavishnu. How many universes are? Too many to count. And the source of all of them is Mahavishnu. But before, it's the prototype Garbhadakshaya Vishnu then expands into all these other Vishnus and all the other Brahmas. And so there's another Lord Shiva, the prototype Shambhu, and he has his residence in Shivaloka. You guys asked for it. And there's this abode called Kailash, and he is the Guna avatar. What does that mean? There are six different categories of avatars, those who descend from the spiritual world for some function, and one of the categories is Guna avatar. They preside over the modes of nature. Are you familiar with these six types of avatars? I'll say them quickly. The one that everybody knows is Lila avatars. No? The Das Avatar Stotra.
Yes,
so those are Lila avatars. That's one. Guna avatar, that's another. They preside over the modes of nature. Vishnu, Shiva, and Brahma, everybody knows. Those are Guna avatars. That's two. Lila avatars, Guna avatars. Shaktyavesh avatar. Shakti Avesh. A living entity that possesses the fullness of the potency of the Supreme Lord for some function. Like the Kumaras. They're possessing the fullness of the Lord's Jnana Shakti. The Shakti Avesh avatars. Pitu Maharaj. His ruling potency or Palana Shakti. And others. Shakti Avesh avatars. Narada Muni is possessing the Lord's fullness of the Lord's Bhakti Shakti. And so forth. There's many in that category. That's three categories. Manvantar avatars. Manus. Manus themselves, each of the day of Brahma, 14 Manus. And within those Manus, there's avatars that are, some of them are known as Manvantar avatars. That's four. Yuga. Avatar comes at the beginning of each of the four yugas and presents the primary means of spiritual perfection for that age. Yuga avatars. What's number six? Purusha avatars. Very good. What's that? Purusha avatars. The Vishnu forms. Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, Sharadakshaya Vishnu. Their function is for the purpose of creation. They're involved with, although they don't directly contact, material nature. The closest that Mahavishnu gets to material nature is he glances. The Chaya Devi or Prakriti or Maya or Durga, like that. He glances, that's all. And then Garbhadakshaya Vishnu enters into each one, and Shiradakshaya Vishnu enters within every atom of creation. So those are the Purusha avatars. That's six. So Lord Shiva, as the popular Lord Shiva that people who commonly worship Lord Shiva, he's a Guna avatar. And he presides over that mode of material nature that is involved in destruction. So better watch out. Don't cross Lord Shiva. He's Ashutosh. There's another name. He's easily pleased and he's easily angered. So don't cross Lord Shiva. You're in big trouble. Daksha crossed him. He was in big trouble. He lost his head. Literally. Okay, so there's a third abode. We haven't gotten to him yet. This is Text 43, it's where he
resides.
And then there's this Mahakalapur. Someone wanted to know something more about that. So we're going to
see the reference found in
Canto 3, Chapter 12. Well, here's Chapter 12 is the creation of Kumaras and others. I mentioned Lord Brahma wanted to fill up the universe that he had just created. So to assist him, he asked the Kumaras to assist him. He said, "No thanks, Dad, we like Brahmacharya life." So he became angry, and Rudra manifested. That Rudra that manifested then expanded into 11 other Rudras, and they started tearing up the universe that Lord Brahma had just created. They're worse than kids. I mean, they were really just ripping everything apart, and some of them even started to attack him. So Lord Brahma turned to the original Rudra and said, "These fellows, can you tell them, not yet. They have a function to perform, but not now. We just got started. Please request them to go to this place, Maha Kalapur, the abode of great time." What's the great time? The time of destruction. And they meditate and do some tapasya, do some austerity, and keep them pacified for a little while, for the duration of the universe. Then I'll call on them, and then they can do their thing. So that's where they went. They went to, at the bottom of the universe, is one of the Mahakalapur places. There's more than one. So at the bottom of the universe, at the time of cosmic annihilation, what happens? There's a long period of drought, no rain. Things get really, really dry. And then from the mouths of Ananta Shesh comes fire. Ananta is holding up the universe and the planets within the universe upon his hoods. Fire comes from his hoods. And the Rudras do a dance that send the flames even further throughout the universe, and everything is burned, and then he withdraws everything. Lord Vishnu then can take everything back to their elemental stage. So that's one of the abodes, the Mahakalapur. But just to keep things correspondingly complicated, there's other references where this Mahakala Dham is located. One of them we read, there's the Sadashiva Loka, and below that there's this darker region called Mahakalapur. That's another one. And then there's another one. That's where in the one of the very last chapters of the 10th canto, you know, in Dwarka, there was a Brahmana whose sons, just after their birth, they disappeared. They didn't die. They just disappeared, like they were kidnapped or something. They just disappeared. One after the next, after the next, after the next, after the next. The Brahmana became very upset. And he said, "This King Ugrasena, what kind of king is he? He can't protect a Brahmana in his kingdom, that child after child after child, they're kidnapped, they just disappear. And Krishna, who's this very famous personality, supposedly, what kind of personality is Ugrasena and Krishna?" He was speaking badly. Arjuna happened to be visiting Krishna at that time. So Arjuna went to the Brahmana and said, "My dear Brahmana, I'm mighty armed Arjuna. With my arrows, I can do anything. So I promise you, I make you this solemn promise. You conceive another son, let me know when the child was to be born, I will come and give my personal protection. And if I fail to do that, I'll give up my life. I'll enter into fire." The Brahmana said, "All right." So just before the child was to be born, this is described in chapter 89, Bhagavatam, Arjuna was notified that the child was to be born. Arjuna came. With his arrows, he created this impenetrable space, just with arrows, that no one could possibly enter. The child was born, and shortly after the child's birth, the child disappeared. So Arjuna was big time distressed. He said, "I'll find your child." He looked here, he looked there, he looked everywhere. He couldn't find the child. He decided, "I'm going to keep my vow. I'm going to give up my life." He built a big fire, about to enter into the fire. And Krishna said, "What are you doing, Arjuna? You took this vow. I have to give up my life." "So I know where the children are. You didn't ask me." "But get in my chariot. I'll take you to where the children are." And they mounted his celestial chariot that went through the upper planetary systems, went through the coverings of the universe, and on the other side of the coverings of the universe, they entered into this bright light, same as what Gopakumar had experienced, because that's a commentary on the Bhagavatam. And Arjuna was blinded by this bright light, and they went to the abode of Mahavishnu. Right? On the other side of the... and within the causal ocean, but so bright and luminous. And Mahavishnu is said in that section that the abode of Mahavishnu is referred to as Mahakalapur. The abode of Mahavishnu is referred to as Mahakalapur. Now, Mahakalapur generally, because it literally means the great time, Mahakala, generally it refers to the abode of Lord Shiva, at least in these two places, at the bottom of the universe or just below Sadashiva Loka. But it can also refer to the abode of Mahavishnu. It's nice that everything is very simple and clear, right? But so his abodes and his manifestations are various. We'll go back to the statement of the verse. It's not in Devidham, the abode. So his abode is not in Haridham and it's not in Devidham, although variously situated, it's his own abode. If we think of three-dimensional space, it doesn't work. But if you think of higher dimensional space, it works. It's an abode. Like, for example, when Krishna appears, he's born in Vrindavan. You can go to that geographical place, and the transcendental abode is not destroyed. It's not destroyed at the time of cosmic annihilation. Doesn't Krishna say that in Bhagavad Gita? He says it in Bhagavad Gita. That abode of mine is not destroyed at the time of annihilation. It's eternal. So we go there, we go to like this, the covering of, but not enter into, the abode of Krishna. Similarly, the abode of Lord Shiva is in this other dimension. Not Devidham. It's not Haridham. It's another dimension. It's Mahishdham. And that's his position. He's in his own category. So that's what the next text, 45. Here's a little description found in Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Lila text, chapter 21. When a living entity is liberated from Devidham but does not know of the opulence of Haridham, he is placed in Mahishdham, which is between the other two. The liberated soul does not get an opportunity to serve the Supreme Lord there. Therefore, although the Mahesh Dham is Lord Shiva's Dham, and above the Devi Dham, it is not the spiritual world. The spiritual world begins with Hari Dham, or Vaikuntha Loka. It's another realm. It's not Hari Dham, it's not Devi Dham, it's Mahesh Dham. After Mahakala Dham comes Sadashiva Loka. Lord Shiva is thus on both sides of Siddha Loka, or the Brahma Jyoti. Both sides. on the lower side, Mahakala. He is Bhutanath, the leader of the atheistic class of men, while on the higher side, Sarashivaloka, he worships Lord Sankarshan through singing, dancing, and other pastimes. Some of us went to South India for a yatra in South India. Were you there? Was anybody here with us? You were there. So one of the places we went is a very famous place in South India, Gurvayur. We went there. And one of the places in Gurvayur is Rudrakund. Rudrakund is described in Srimad Bhagavatam as the place where the sons of King Prajinibari, called the Prachetas, were going to carry out the Prajapati service that their father had asked of them. And as they were about to enter into the sea, who greeted them but Lord Shiva? He came out of the sea with all of his associates, and he very kindly gave them some stotras that he recites in his meditation, worshipping Lord Sankarshan. It mentions the other forms of the Chaturvyuha, Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha, but Lord Shiva is a worshipper of Lord Sankarshan. In case you didn't know, now you know. When he's in meditation, that's who he's meditating upon. In his purport to this Chaitanya Charitamrita verse, Bhaktisiddhanta states that Shivadham includes both Mahakala and Sarashivaloka. Okay. There's the 11 Rudras that expand from the original Rudra that comes from the forehead of Lord Brahma. So there's another name. Okay. Now we're going to go to text 45. This specifically, the previous verse is describing his abodes and the opulences that go with those abodes. This is now going to describe him. Some of these terms in the first line, dadhi, yogurt, and vikara means transformation, Sanskrit word that means transformation, and vikara vishesha, the very special kind of transformation where yata means, that's a comparison, like, you know, kids will learn in school about metaphor and simile. Like and as indicates something known is being used to allude to or describe something unknown. Like this, so this. Yata, tata in Sanskrit. Yata, tata. So, milk, kshiram, yata, dadhi. Vikara Vishesha Yogat, by the application of a souring agent, different, you know, some lemon or whatever, you know, make milk hot and put some souring agent in, and it transforms into dahi. So as that, then Tata, Lord Shiva, is, or Shambhu, is a transformation of Lord Vishnu. It's the glance of Mahavishnu. The distinction between Lord Shiva and Lord Vishnu is, Lord Vishnu does not contact Maya, Lord Shiva contacts Maya. Ah. I used to, you know, in my brahmachari days would wonder, ponder this, you know, like, Garbhadakshay, here's two things. Garbhadakshay Vishnu is fully spiritual. From the navel of Garbhadakshay Vishnu comes a lotus stem, on top of the lotus stem is a lotus flower, on top of the lotus flower is Lord Brahma. So where's, you know, where's the spiritual and material connect? Because Lord Brahma has a material body. He's born and he dies. And Garbhadakshay Vishnu has a spiritual body. Doesn't born, it's not born, doesn't die. What about that stem? And the flower on top of the stem. Would you like to know what it says about that? It represents, or it's a manifestation, according to Srimad Bhagavatam, it's a manifestation of the sum total karma of all living entities. That's a lot of karma.
Yeah.
And within the stem, all the living entities that are going to appear within the universe are situated. The first of them that appears on top is Lord Brahma, most elevated amongst them. So now here's another one. Here's Mahavishnu, who is fully spiritual. And then there's this glance of Mahavishnu. Now, is the glance of Mahavishnu fully spiritual or not fully spiritual? Fully spiritual. Fully spiritual. But when the glance contacts Maya, or Chaya Devi, or Pradhan, it's the halo of the glance, that's Shambhu, he contacts Maya. That's the tamarind, or the lemon, or the souring agent. So, Lord Shiva becomes influenced, we're going to hear, by three different things. That's the, you know, the souring agent, or the transformation part. So he's in his own tattva. He's not a living entity. He's not a jiva. And he's not Vishnu tattva either. He's Shiva tattva. So what's his position? He's Shiva tattva. That's what his position is. And how does it work? We're hearing how it works. Let's see what. His glance is spiritual. Anything in relation to the Supreme Lord is fully spiritual. His glance per se is fully spiritual. His glance, however, when contacting the material energy for the purpose of impregnating the living entities within the womb of material nature, that function is a Shambhu function. He contacts Maya directly. He impregnates Maya. That's a material function. And Lord Vishnu doesn't directly do that. Shambhu does. And there's the distinction. So let's just read. Let's keep going. Just as, this is yatha, just as milk is transformed into curd or dahi by the action of acids, but yet the effect curd is neither the same as nor different from its cause, namely milk. Not the same as, it's not different from. A little tricky, isn't it? So is Lord Shiva Vishnu or is he not Vishnu? Well, he's the same as but different from. What's that? That's your the topic. What's his position? So we can look at him in either way. But if you want to look at him in one way, you need to look at him in the other way. If you look at him the other way, you need to look at him in the first way. He's in his own tattva. He's in his own category. Dahi is not milk. And the old ladies that work in the kitchen, you know. Once something gets transformed into dahi, you can't transform it back into milk. Too bad. Once it's dahi. And it has its uses. You can do so many shrikhand, so many things you can make with dahi. You may purposely curdle milk. But it's not the same. It's nothing but a milk product, but it's not milk anymore. And you can't transform it back. So let me just keep going. So this is the yata, and let's do the tata. There's milk, there's the lemon juice, there's the dahi. They're same as but different from. So, I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, of whom the state of Shambhu is a transformation for the performance of the work of destruction. This is Lord Shiva and Parvati worshipping Sankarsha. And he's offering prayers. There's a section of the Bhagavatam where his prayers to Sankarsha are being presented. One of them is, as mentioned, in the before to the Prachetas. The Song of Lord Shiva is called, that section of the Bhagavatam. So he does the creation or procreation part. He also does the destruction part. We're going to hear a little bit more about that. So there's milk. This is from Bhaktisiddhanta purport. Please excuse his language. But that's how he writes. It's a little difficult. The non-distinction between Krishna and Shiva is established by the fact that just as milk treated with acid turns into curd, so Godhead becomes a subservient when he himself attains a distinct personality by the addition of a particular element of adulteration. It's like yata, it's like adding the lemon to the milk. So tata is Lord Shiva contacts Maya for the purpose of serving the interest of Lord Vishnu. He wants the living entities and these two compassionate desires mentioned. And so now he attains a distinct personality. What's that? Lord Shiva. And what's the particular element of adulteration? Well, let's find out. The said adulterating principle is constituted of a combination of three. One, the stupefying quality of diluting energy. So Maya, who he contacts, which Mahavishnu does not, Maya has a diluting influence, a stupefying influence. So, very, very small. Very small. But some small degree, this adulteration is this one. Then number two, the quality of non-plentitude of the marginal potency. And we'll see the next slide. This is Bhaktisiddhanta's language. So, the Supreme Lord is Vibhu, the living entity is Anu. Tiny, tiny. So, because Lord Shiva is serving this function on behalf of the living entities, he's carrying all the living entities into the field of material nature. He accepts a small degree of their non-plentitude. You know, something that's not what Mahavishnu is. This is his language, the adulterating principle. Has these two so far. And three, a slight degree of the ecstatic cum cognitive principle of the plenary spiritual potency. What's that? The Sat Chit Ananda. Ecstatic Ananda. And cognitive is Chit. So, to a small degree, that spiritual potency he carries, not to a full degree, Mahavishnu to a full degree, he has Ramadevi. Lord Shiva to a small degree. Slight degree.
That's the position of Lord Shiva.
And from text 33, this is text 45 that we're discussing from Brahma Samhita. I hope you don't mind all this scholarship. But it gives you details that otherwise you just kind of, you know, have a faint directional kind of notion somewhere that away. You know, it's like a GPS gets you exactly in a mile and a half. Make sure you turn right. In 3/4 of a mile, remember, you got to turn right. Turn right. Details. So we're doing that kind of thing. So I don't have to read. Text 33, Goloka reveals itself to every jiva soul when he is under the influence of the spiritual cognitive potency joined to the essence of ecstatic energy. Bhaktisiddhanta's language. So in order to become God conscious, to become a God realized soul, you must be in touch with the internal potency. And specifically, the cognitive aspect and the bliss aspect. So the bliss aspect, that's Srimati Radharani. She inspires devotional service. And also, in that internal potency, there's inbuilt or within, there's all knowledge. Sat and Chit and Ananda. By the agency of the internal potency. The ecstatic function of devotion is boundless and surcharged with unalloyed transcendental knowledge. Radharani imparts knowledge. She does. And that same understanding is found in Srimad Bhagavatam in Canto 1, Chapter 2. And the verse goes like this. It's a very famous verse. If you stick around Krishna consciousness for a while, you'll know this verse. Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojataha Jani Ati Ashu Vairagyam Gyanam Cha Yadahai Tukam. Ahaitukam. Hetu means cause. And ahaitukam means without cause. Causelessly, you engage in devotional service. Two things. Detachment from material and knowledge awakens. That's what's this last thing. You engage in devotional service, that's the ecstatic potency or the internal pleasure potency of Krishna. That's Srimati Radharani. She's that pleasure potency. And when you engage in her devotional service, she, or that process of devotion, is surcharged with unalloyed transcendental knowledge. You don't need to go become a jnani. Just become a devotee, and everything that you need to know, you'll know. Everything knowable will become known. Everything that you need to know to go to Krishna. Why? Because he discloses everything you need to know. He says, Dadami bodhi yogam tam. Yena mamo piyantite. Yes? one of the Chatur Shloki verses of the Bhagavatam. Tesham Satata Yoktanam Vajatam Pratipurlakam Dadami Buddhiyogam Tam. Well, the adulterating principle of Lord Shiva, what is his position, is the topic. Bhakti Siddhanta's teaching in this text 45, the commentary, from the authority of Scripture. These are the features that you can say diminish or transform milk to yogurt or Mahavishnu's glands to Shambhu. These three features. That's the lemon. That's his position. And then another very nice, important teaching is presented by Rupa Goswami. Boy, we've hit three of the six Goswamis this evening. Rupa Goswami is one of the six Goswamis in Vrindavan, and he was specifically instructed by Lord Chaitanya in the science of bhakti, or devotion. So he wrote a text, very wonderful text, Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu, which Prabhupada made a summary study of called Nectar Devotion. And one day, when you all become ready for systematic study of the essential devotional texts, that's one of the ones you're going to study, Nectar Devotion. Within ISKCON, we have this Bhakti Shastri certification. Maybe some of you are taking the Bhakti Shastri course. Some of them are given online, and so forth and so on. So, Nectar Devotion is one of those books that you'll study. And in text chapter 21, you'll find a chapter that discusses 64 qualities of Krishna and the living entities have a 50 of those 64 qualities in a small degree. And then Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma possess another 5, but not in full. They possess the 50 that living entities have more fully, and they possess another 5 that the living entities don't have, because he's just in his own tattva. And Lord Brahma possesses less of them, Lord Shiva possesses more of them, and Vishnu possesses them in full. So here's the 5, and it's very fascinating. Changeless, all cognizant, ever fresh, Satchit Ananda, eternal, blissful body, possessing all mystic perfections. So, the language is that they possess these qualities to some degree. So what's it, to some degree changeless? What does that mean, to some degree changeless? Well, it's not eternal because the time energy is influencing. Whereas the time energy isn't influencing Mahavishnu. But the expanse of his time, or the expanse of the life of Brahma. I got to keep track of time because I have a flight tomorrow morning. But I'm obviously enjoying presenting the topic. And you're going to have a bunch of questions. I know it. Because that's the kind of wonderful group you are. So I think I'll skip this explanation. It's not that the body of Lord Brahma or the body of Lord Shiva are literally, eternally existing full of bliss and knowledge. They're very long duration, and their knowledge capacity is far, far greater than any living entity. But it's not full Satchit Ananda, not fully changeless, not fully all cognizant. Who is all cognizant? Krishna, or the Lord of the Heart, Super Soul. So what knowledge... just set it down. Thank you very much. Just down. The knowledge that's possessed by Lord Shiva, he doesn't know everything that Vishnu knows. He's omniscient. Super Soul is within the heart of every atom and within every living being. That's not the position of Lord Shiva. He's not all cognizant like that. But he's so intimately connected with the Supreme Lord, he's far, far beyond the living entities in cognizance and his form and mystic powers. But from the Bhagavatam we have this description of a battle when the potencies of the personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna or Govinda, supersede. As this whole section is saying, the powers of Lord Shiva are derived from, the powers of all living entities are derived from the absolute truth, the source of everything. Okay, we're almost done. The divine nature, this is explaining what I just showed you, the five qualities of Shambhu and Brahma. The divine nature is present in a greater measure in Shambhu than Brahma. The fundamental significance of the above, that first sentence, is that the aggregate of 50 attributes belonging to the jivas are present in a fuller measure in Brahma, who possesses, in a lesser degree, 5 more attributes which are not found in jivas. But in Shambhu, both the 50 attributes of the jivas as also the 5 additional attributes found in Brahma are present in even greater measure than Brahma. That's pretty clear, right? Okay, good. Now, these functions that Lord Shiva performs, the function of creation, the original procreation, and then the function of destruction. This is Bhaktisiddhanta's language. Shambhu, in pursuance of the will of Govinda, works in union with his consort Durga Devi by his own time energy. So time brings things into being and time destroys things. Here we are assembled. It took some time to get here. And we're here for a while. And they're all going to disperse, at least most of us. Some of you live here. But times bring things together, time destroys things. And that's happening under the influence of Lord Shiva's time energy. He's the destroyer. This function of destruction, again, this is Bhaktisiddhanta's language in his commentary. Govinda manifests himself as a guna avatar in the form of Shambhu, who is the separated portion of Govinda, imbued with the principle of his subjective plenary portion. There he goes again with his language. This means his expansion. Shambhu performs the work of destruction in the material world. There's his dance, the Tandava Nritya, the dance of destruction. And he's assisting, when he does this dance, he's assisting Ananta. Fire coming from his mouth, and he spreads the fire through his dance. So that Mahakala, Pur, is where the Rudras are residing, waiting for that destruction time. And they do their dance. I read this. No, I didn't read this. This is again from this chapter 12. This is chapter 12 of Canto 3, is the appearance of the 4 Kumaras and others. So here's others. This is Rudra. The creation of Rudra, this is Prabhupada's purport to that verse. The creation of Rudra from between the eyebrows of Brahma is the result of his anger generated from the mode of passion. Brahma's presiding deity of the mode of passion, partly touched by ignorance, very significant. In Bhagavad Gita 3:37, the principle of Rudra is described. Krodha, anger, is the product of kama, or lust, which is the result of the mode of passion. When lust and hankering are unsatisfied, the element of krodha appears, which is the formidable enemy of the conditioned soul. This most sinful and inimical passion is represented as
ahankar,
false ego. False egocentric attitude of thinking oneself to be all in all. Such an egocentric attitude on the part of the conditioned soul who is completely under the control of the material nature is described in Bhagavad Gita as foolish. The egocentric attitude is a manifestation of the Rudra principle in the heart, wherein krodha or anger is generated. Kamesha, Krodesha, Rajoguna, Samudbhava. Arjuna asks, why is it that people do things, even they decide not to do those things, against their will, apparently? How is it? And this is his answer. Kamesha, Krodesha, Rajoguna, it all starts with associating with the motive passion. And from motive passion, kama. And when kama isn't satisfied, krodha. That's material life. And the person who presides over that egocentric attitude, what's that? Thinking oneself to be all in all. Who presides over that? Rudra. It's a manifestation of the Rudra principle. So it's a function. You know, topic is what's the position of Lord Shiva. This is one of the aspects of this complex subject of Lord Shiva. He presides, he's a guna avatar, he presides over the mode of ignorance, he assists in the process of creation, he assists in the process of destruction, and in between creation and destruction, he presides over the egoistic principle. And when passion is not satisfied, krodha appears. Rudra does his dance. And we get disturbed. He can also be very easily satisfied. There's a and then just this is the last slide. The description, there's a nice description of the crescent moon. Things here, like, you know, I was always wondering, it's always there with Lord Shiva, what's the significance? Because the water that we know is holding the Ganges in his hair. What's the crescent moon? So here's a little description. Last slide. Balachandra, the crescent moon, was produced from the churning of the milk ocean because of its cooling effect. Balachandra was offered to Lord Shiva to wear in his head since he was feeling dizzy from having drunk the poison. Oh. Nilakanta. Another name of Lord Shiva. So there is Balachandra, the crescent moon. So there's the last slide. It's 9:15. You have a question? Yeah.
When you were talking about the destruction,
like, yes.
Everyone goes into the Mahavishnu, and you were talking about the jivas, right?
Yes.
Also mentioned that like when we were discussing about the 15 gunas and they are beyond that, and he spoke about the time energy principle.
I said all those things.
Yeah. So I was a bit confused there. So if everyone has a distribution back into Mahavishnu, I mean Shiva, the way he has been manifested, and Brahma also will have a distribution back into Mahavishnu.
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. Lord Brahma may go to Vaikuntha. At the time of cosmic annihilation, there are multiple, that's another slide, another verse, the position of Lord Brahma. Some Lord Brahmas, they go back to Godhead. They don't necessarily go back into the body of Mahavishnu.
And what about
Shiva? Well, he's in his own tattva.
But he has a definitive...
He has a...
Right? right? So what happens to
that? Well, Shivaloka isn't destroyed. So from Shivaloka, expansions of Shiva come. Correct? We read text 15, where the prototype Shambhu is manifest. Where is he manifest from? The forehead of Mahavishnu. So he has his eternal. He's not. He doesn't come from. He's manifest from. Oh, but he has his own abode.
In this realm,
everything is destroyed. When cosmic annihilation comes, everything is destroyed, except for the Sweta Dweep, the abode of Mahavishnu. Everything else, including Kailash and everything else is destroyed. But his abode is not Devi Dham. His abode is Mahesh Dham. And that upper region is complex. But that upper region, Sada Shiva Loka, isn't destroyed. It's in the region of Haridam. But it's not Haridam. It's in the region of. It's his own realm. That part is not destroyed. So the other features are withdrawn. Just like it's complex. What can I do? It's complex.
I was just understanding in a different way, obviously. This is how I was thinking. So you have Mahavishnu, and then you have the 11 principles, like the whole thing that happens. And then you have Shambhu who comes up.
Yeah.
Now this whole process occurs only when the cause for a new universe
yes, correct.
Has taken place.
Right? In a sense, it happens cyclical, again and again and again.
Yeah, so how okay, the first time...
When there's cosmic annihilation... There's not a first time. It's cyclical. It's cyclical. It's endlessly cyclical. Don't think of it as, you know, what happened before there was one. It's endlessly cyclical. The Supreme Lord is eternal. This is another concept in your question. But as God is eternal, time is eternal, and these features of the cosmic manifestation, maintenance, and annihilation... and resting for some time, and again, there's not, once upon a time there wasn't one, and then there was the first one. That was your language. The first one. There wasn't a first one. It's just cyclical. And the Supreme Lord has his abode, and that's, you know, Goloka and Haridam. And then there is this Mahesh Dham. And he has his abode. That's Sada Shiva Loka. When the purpose of creation comes, it's time. The time energy moves in such a way Devi Dham needs to be created. He appears from the brow of Mahavishnu, and within each universe he appears as the son of Lord Brahma and does his thing. And the time for cosmic annihilation comes, he goes back to his Sada Shiva Loka. He's an expansion of that one.
So it's more like an energy principle is what you're saying?
It's a personal principle. He expands. It's energy, yes, but it's more than energy, it's person. With a person comes energy, like you, or me, or any one of us. Energy is resting upon a person. So he has his capacities that aren't of the fullness. Yes. That's his position. Then that's our topic. I mean, we could have had a 5-minute class and just said, less. He's in his own category. And there's only one in his category. And that's him. There's living entities, countless living entities, unlimited numbers of living entities. Now there are expansions of Lord Shiva. He expands in different ways, for different functions, and have different abodes and residences, although they're all Mahesh Dham, variously situated, called by different names according to the function that he's performing. He's one entity, variously manifested according to, you know, his position of service is these items that we've mentioned. The procreation service, the destruction service, you know, the helping of living entities who are of such and such nature to, you know, be faithful to him and become elevated and protected by him. Those that are of much higher nature, like the Pranchetas, to worship Sankarshan, like he does. He's just very merciful. He's very merciful. And therefore people appreciate him and worship him because he's so merciful. But generally when they worship him, antavatu palam tesham, they want something limited and temporary. And he can give something limited and temporary. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, he makes their faith strong, so they worship him to get something limited and temporary. But he's ready to give something far more than that. He has his own sampradaya, Rudra Sampradaya. And his Rudra Sampradaya is teaching Shuddha Bhakti. But some people don't want Shuddha Bhakti. They want something limited and temporary. So they worship him in a different way. So they're worshiping a different aspect of him, but it's still an aspect of him. And as Vaishnavas, we should understand his position. That's what we're doing this evening, discussing elaborately, maybe a little confusing, but elaborately, what his position is. Yes?
This is regarding Rudra coming from Brahma.
Yeah, okay.
So if Brahma is not born in Vijayana, he has a
father. Yes, he does.
So similarly, Rudra belongs. So only the Shiva in the Sadashiva
God, yeah,
is the parents of Brahma.
Yes, that's correct.
So he's the one who's going
to be... He's a direct expansion. Sadashiva, in Sadashiva Loka, we read, is direct expansion of Krishna for the purpose of pastimes. Now we're hearing about some of those pastimes in relation to creation primarily.
So Rudra is... Every time there's going to be cosmic contamination, Rudra will be born and then he'll be here.
You got it. And he's unique. He's not... Different persons can occupy the post of Brahma. Because it's a post. But there's only one person who occupies the position of Rudra, and that's Rudra.
But he comes from Brahma.
He appears that way, but he doesn't come from him. Like, you know, we walked through that door, but we didn't come through the door. We didn't come from the door.
Okay.
Yes.
So Lord Shiva is accepting the mode of passion and ignorance for the service of...
Lord Shiva accepts the charge of the mode of ignorance. He's not... he's not an ignorant person. He accepts charge. He oversees that mode of nature, the function of which is destruction. Passion creates, goodness maintains, and ignorance destroys. So he oversees that mode of nature for the purpose of destruction. In fact, not just at cosmic annihilation. Everything that comes into being through passion is destroyed. It does it through the, it says, through the agency of his time energy.
So, he does it as a service?
Yes, he does it as a service.
Assisting to Lord Krishna?
Yes.
So, Maharaj, is
there... He's the greatest of all Vaishnavas, yes, according to Srimad Bhagavatam. Vaishnavanam yata shambhu. Greatest of all Vaishnavas. He's a Vaishnava. And we're trying to become Vaishnavas.
Just was curious to know, Guru Maharaj, that why does he... accepts this bone garland and lives in a specific way.
It's just what he does. he's He doesn't follow convention. I mean, that was one of the things that Gopal Kumar said. Look at this. He doesn't follow, you know, civil codes. And, you know, Daksha didn't see it like that. Daksha was criticizing him. My daughter's married to this fellow that does this and that and another thing. He became an offender to Lord Shiva. He had a problem from that offense. So we don't make that offense. He's on another platform. You know, why he does, he just does like that. That's all we need to know, he does like that. And there are persons who will go, wow, you know, the Buddhas and those persons think, you know, he's cool or something. So, in ashes from a crematorium and this and that. And so, but he's not affected by that. So why does he do that? It's just how he does things. And we don't ask him, why do you do that?
If Maharaj, yadi and Acharati Shrestha, so Vaishnavas are meant to follow in footsteps of Mahajana, so...
But we should not... What Prabhupada writes specifically about this is we should not imitate. If one can swallow an ocean of poison, then you can do the things that Lord Shiva does. And if you can't, then don't imitate. The following is just see what a great devotee, what a great Vaishnava he is. To serve all the living entities, he's swallowing, holding in his throat all this poison, and holding the Ganges on his head as it's descending from the spiritual world or from the river of inner jaw. He's just serving. He's that, and has capacity that, you know, we can't even imagine. Follow, don't imitate. Something else? Yeah. Yes, correct. But internal potency is internal potency. And the reflection of that internal potency is something else. It's one of Krishna, it's one of Mahavishnu's energies or Krishna's energies. It's one of his energies, but he doesn't directly contact it. That's the distinction. Not exactly. The external energy is another one of his energies. It's a reflection of his internal energy. You're using language that I'm pondering over the language. It's not, I don't think it's within this is that. That's your language. It's another energy that we to best understand it, it's a reflection of.
Then he said it's a reflection of the internal energy, the object from which it reflects the part of the internal energy.
No. Well, listen to this. Here's an apple, here's a mirror. So, in the mirror, there's a reflection of the apple. But there's no, you can't eat the reflection. There's no substance there. So Maya is not within the internal potency. Maya is a reflection of the internal potency. And there's no substance here, although people are running after it like there is. Thinking it's very substantial. Let me get this and that and the other thing. It's very substantial. But, you know, as soon as the mirror turns a little bit, the whole thing is gone. The reflection. The energy isn't gone, but the reflection is gone. That which you think is substantial. It's Maya. Maya Shakti. The potency of Maya. The deluding potency of Maya. Maya means not this.
Oh.
Yeah, that's what it means. Maya, not this. And we keep going for it. That's the deluding potency of Maya. Yeah, just I think what you need to do is keep chanting. And hearing. And, you know, it's transcendental knowledge. It's not something, it's not going to be understood by ascending process like you might understand, you know, computer programming or something. It's the descending process. It'll come, you know, it'll sit in your heart and the light will go on. Oh, that's what it means. And that method, it'll become more clear. Yes. Well, let's go back to the very first verse. Ishvara Parama Krishna. So, Lord Shiva is certainly he's a controller. And from whom does he derive his power to control? That's what the whole of Brahma Samhita is saying. That's the nature of the absolute truth. That from which everything comes, including the power of Lord Shiva to control. Or the power of anyone to do anything. Yes.
Such a great God, so we just look over all his qualities and everything. Why do we call him a demigod? Is it not demeaning to call him a demigod, like Shiva?
Well, you know, the Sanskrit term is devata. But, you know, if you have to speak to an English-speaking audience, which was the assignment that Prabhupada was given, there's God. And then there's one who is answerable to the Supreme God. So you could say demeaning, but it's actually the position.
That's a beautiful word, Supreme God and God. Why can't we say
Lord we can say that.
Supreme God and Lord Shiva?
Yeah, that's the one reason why to not do that is as soon as you say God, then for some people, not everybody, some people it conjures to the mind pantheism. You know what pantheism means? Pantheism? Pantheism means many, many, many gods. Let me just share something with you. I was in, one of the places I visit is China. So, the first time I went to visit in Beijing, I was astonished by several things. One was the amount of air pollution. Another was the number of people, because, you know, in New York, I spent lots of time in New York, you used to see like so many people. It's nothing. It's like a little ghost town compared to Beijing. There's so many people, it's ridiculous. Everywhere. And one of the things that was very astonishing is demigod worship was part of the Ming Dynasty. And I found that out because somebody I was staying with wanted to, you know, can you want to go see some tourist places? He says, no. Come on, please come, please come. No, no, no. Please come, please come. Oh, please come, please come. All right, all right, all right. Where do you want to go? I don't know. You know the places. So we went to the Temple of Heaven. One of the big tourist places right across the street from the Ming Dynasty Palace, and it's like, you know, it's like Central Park. Big place. And then across the street is the Temple of Heaven. You have to pay to get in, and it's like 5 central parks in size, and it's like the number of people was like rush hour, heading, you know, heading for the A train in rush hour in New York City, and it was at 2 o'clock in the afternoon after lunch hour, and there was a zillion gazillion people inside. And then, you know, there's 3 hills where the Ming Dynasty people did their demigod worship. I didn't know, they're just like taking me. I didn't know what I was going to go and see. I said to the translator, said, there's so many people. She said, in China, we're used to it. Okay. So we went up this kind of like a mound. And then the central part is where they would worship the King of Heaven, because it's the Temple of Heaven. So in the back, it's kind of like a U-shaped area. You'll have this, like, you have to stand in line for an hour just to get a quick glimpse of the darshan of, not Balaji, but, you know, the Temple of Heaven. And up, raised in the back, is Indra. Well, he didn't say Indra, you know, the King of Heaven. And over here is the sun god, the moon god, and the fire god, and the wind god, and the demigods. Ming Dynasty engaged in demigod worship. And it's like a national monument. Because there was a period when Vedic culture was all over, including in Beijing. You know, the longest standing capital of the whole of China. So, you know, they're worshipping the King of Heaven, but in China they don't have a concept of the Supreme God. They don't even have a concept. So if we just say gods or gods, God or gods, and then it's pantheism, that's pantheism. They don't have a concept of supreme. Even if you use the language supreme God, or we can do it in India, supreme God, and it means who's your favorite? He's the supreme God. So there is a distinction in language. There's Bhagavan, and then there's the devas. So translate that into English, and, you know, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, it's purposeful. It's like the long description why Prabhupada chose those words. The Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then where it says the devas, or devatas, to make the distinction for the Western audience very clear, it's not demeaning, it's their position. They're controllers, but they're small controllers. They're not Parameshwara. They're devas. So to make it very clear for the English audience, that was the language. Now, you prefer something else, that you weren't, you know, you weren't translating books for the world to introduce to them Vedic wisdom, so they can understand the conclusion of Sarvadharmam Parityaja Amekam Sharanam Raja. It wasn't done with a demeaning intention, it was done with a making the distinction clear. So there isn't any lack of clarity. So if you like, you can use this other language. The Supreme God and various gods. There are various Ishwaras. And there's a Parameshwara. That's the language of Brahma Samhita. So many Ishwaras, and there's a Parameshwara.
The Western people call Achilles, Hercules as demigods.
Huh?
Achilles, Hercules, the Greek warriors, they call them the demigods.
Yeah.
So when we say demigod, are we not equating those human-like people to the Lord here?
Well, you know, the Greek mythology,
it's completely different.
Where does it come from? It comes from Vedic teachings. And when Parshuram, Lord Parshuram, he drove the decadent kings from India, they scattered in different directions, and some of them ended up in Greece. So they just they use different names over a period of time, but it's the same devatas with different names. What do you think?
Yeah,
I know somebody that has 5 PhDs in linguistics, and one of the PhDs was how the Greek language is derived from the Sanskrit language.
Wow.
They live in Peru. They're very, very bright people. They're very humble, but very bright. And so, you know, the pantheon of Greek literature comes from Vedic literature, as the language comes from Sanskrit. Twisted. For sure.
I'm from a place where they celebrate Lord Shiva in a beautiful manner in a different language. And for me, this demigod was the worst nightmare.
It hurts.
Happy being acceptable that way. But that's me.
You asked for the topic. When he asked for the topic, I said that some people may be hurt.
No, I'm not hurt. It's
okay.
Just that I'm not at all hurt.
Okay, fine. Okay. Okay, I'm thinking of my flight tomorrow morning. And I'm looking at the clock. And I think I'm going to have to exit stage left real fast.
Thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
So what's going on?